Blog Talk Radio. Product Management Talk, a regular broadcast for passionate product professionals and business people that don't get a chance to leave their desk and participate in product talks in person, so we bring product talks to you wherever you are. Every episode, we discuss different aspects of what it takes to produce successful products. Everyone is invited, including agile practitioners, user experience designers, content and community managers, business owners, CEOs, entrepreneurs, social media strategists, innovation managers, business analysts, project managers, product managers, program managers, product marketing managers, brand managers, software developers, and you, as well as everyone involved with the entire product lifecycle process from inception to sunsetting. Follow us on Blog Talk Radio. Go to www.blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMTTALK. That's our website, www.PRODMGMTTALK.com. Follow us on Twitter at PRODMGMTTALK and use the hashtag to tweet answers to the questions and follow the tweets #, PRODMGMTTALK. Discover how to work together to develop amazing products. Startup Product Summit, February 7th, 2013. StartupProduct.com. Join us in person for lively discussions and great networking with product professionals at Startup Product Talks San Francisco Monthly. Go to sfproducttalks.com to find out more. Thank you to our platinum sponsor, the Association of International Product Marketing and Management. Visit them on the web, www.aipmm.com. The AIPMM is a worldwide certifying body of product marketing, management, and team professionals. The AIPMM promotes worldwide excellence and forwards product management professionalism with certification credentials, education, trainings, networking, and professional growth opportunities. AIPMM membership benefits include eligibility for certification, partner offerings and training discounts, productivity tools, career center, mentor matching, advanced access to new curriculums, webinar series, thought leaders, and private events. AIPMM certification credentials allow individual members to demonstrate their level of expertise and provide corporate members an assurance that their product professionals are operating at peak performance. Subscribe to the AIPMM Product Management News and Views newsletter, www.aipmm.com/subscribe. Follow at AIPMM on Twitter. This is Cindy F. Solomon, your host for the Global Product Management Talk, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Follow me on Twitter at Cindy F. Solomon and on the web, cindyfsolomon.com. Hello, and welcome to our first episode of 2013. Today we're talking with Joe Stump, who is the CEO and co-founder of Sprintly, the software iterative development process enables every product iteration to result in at least one software release. Because of its collaborative, problem-solving character, iterative software development is similar to a multidisciplinary project or parallel development, which places a high demand on communication between the project team and the project stakeholders and among team members themselves. It's also referred to as non-blocking development. This process aligns the entire business from sales to software development, to ship more product more quickly. Our speaker today, Joe Stump, is a seasoned technical leader and serial entrepreneur who has co-founded three venture-backed startups, including Simple Geo and Attachments.me. He was the lead architect of Dig and has invested in and advised dozens of companies. He's passionate about development processes, iterative product development, and building scalable web infrastructure. He's worked on small systems with fledgling startups and massive process and technical changes at multinational corporations. Joe, how are you today?
Good. How are you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, delighted to speak with you, finally using voice. We've been chatting a lot through text. Oh, and by the way, I forgot to mention Joe is speaking at Startup Product Summit on February 7th in San Francisco, startupproduct.com. Very exciting. And also, we have a giveaway today. That giveaway for participants is 6 months of unlimited free trial of Sprintly. So you can tell us more about that, and did I leave anything out in the introduction?
No, I think you guys covered it very well. So I'm excited to be on, and thanks again for having me, and stoked to talk more about how everyone can possibly ship a little bit more product this month.
Great. So why don't we do some definitions. The audience, by the way, shout out to the local listening audience from startupproduct.com and sfproducttalks.com. But the audience is growing, which is very exciting. We have over 23,000 listeners who come from all parts of the business. So why don't we explain exactly what you mean by iterative development process?
So the iterative product development that we're largely doing, well, we are doing here at Sprintly, I think really is one of the issues I had as a developer working at startups was that a lot of the ideas that got bannered about and were actually built were done mostly because people thought that they would be a cool idea, or they saw somebody else kind of had done it, rather than the approach that we take in as developers, which is very much you do something, you do a small experiment, you measure it, and then you revisit, right? And I think the approach of iterative product development is basically bringing that same metrics-driven approach that we've used in development for quite some time to the actual kind of product process, where you almost have to have this almost, I will say, like almost like draconian approach, where it's like, you know, to the numbers, where you have very specific KPIs that will increase engagement, which hopefully obviously will translate to revenue. And I think too often the product process gets bogged down by gut instinct and what kind of current customers are asking for and whatnot, rather than what the numbers are actually saying, and being very targeted at pushing one of those up or down. So our approach is very much to look at a specific KPI and measure why we feel that KPI is not as high or as low, obviously if it's churn, as it should be, and then take a very kind of, you know, kind of chip away at the problem approach over sprint after sprint or milestone after milestone.
Okay, so by the way, KPI is a key performance indicator, which is used in management processes. But what you're doing was not something that is possible, or is it possible, if your product is not web-based?
I think if it's not a connected product, it becomes a lot more difficult, but I still think it's possible. Mainly the bigger problem when you don't have a connected product, I think that, you know, a lot of the principles that we use in the web, it's just easier, right? It's a lot easier for me to track engagement and every time someone does something with my product because it's telling me that, right? So I think the real problem that folks who are outside of you know, the web and kind of connected product space the real problem is measuring. If you can figure out a way to measure the KPIs, it really everything else kind of cascades from there. And I think that there are some techniques that we use online that you could readily use in offline products. For instance, exit surveys and things like that, like, you know, basically why people aren't using your product. I think that's a really important thing that a lot of people tend to get confused about, you know, whether or not there's a big difference between why somebody is using your product and what they want versus why somebody didn't use your product at all. So I think the real problem comes more in measuring. If you can measure it, then obviously you can, you know, knowing's half the battle, as G.I. Joe said. So I think really it's about measuring, and then if you can get that measurement, it should apply to, you know, this approach should work easily as well for other products as well.
Excellent. By the way, this is a web-based discussion. Please follow us on Twitter at PRODMGMTTALK and use the hashtag PRODMGMTTALK. I want to do a shout-out to Hidden Shah. Thanks for joining us. He's tweeting and hopefully listening, and also to Capture Your Flag, at Capture Your Flag. So feel free to tweet. It's difficult for me to tweet and talk, so please, audience, do the tweeting for me so I can stay engaged with Joe here. So let's go. I've posted some questions, and for the tweeting audience, the first question is always, please introduce yourself, where you're tweeting from, and your involvement with product management. Hidden, please also introduce yourself. Joe and I are also out there tweeting. But so the Q1, which I will repost, is what do you think is currently wrong with product development? And that's a huge question. We could spend the next four days talking about that, but within the context of this conversation. But I do invite the audience to tweet their answers. What do you think is wrong in your environment with product development?
I think the problem that I always ran into, and you know, I'm only going to talk about obviously the places I've worked at and kind of helped with, and what seems to be a reoccurring problem that I think is really holding product development back is it's still not cross-functional enough. And this is something that, you know, if you look at some of the more successful kind of products, like companies that are shipping amazing products at scale, I think a couple of those companies are, for instance, Facebook and Apple. I think that they ship amazing products at an amazing clip with some pretty amazing results. And the one thing that I've noticed that's dramatically different about their approach as opposed to a lot of other kind of companies' approach is that they have very small, discrete teams with domain-specific knowledge that are empowered at the edges of the organization. So what I mean by that, for instance, is the very first version of Mobile Safari made for the iPhone was made by one or two people. Like, they literally drove the whole product to completion. And I think really the problem that I see over and over in companies is when there is a single point of failure in product-making decisions. And what I mean by that is that, you know, if you have a product person working with a development team and maybe a designer, and they're working on moving something forward, but every time it comes to a key and critical kind of decision about the product, they have to go back to somebody else. And sometimes that happens via a weekly, you know, kind of sync up meeting. I think that's really a part of the process right now that is really, really broken. So my goal, kind of, I think, moving forward, and one of the goals that we're really working on hard at Sprintly is, you know, I hate the phrase, it really all maps back to the phrase, throw it over the wall. And I've never really understood why inside organizations we have walls. I thought we were all on the same team. And that's really what we're trying to fix, is that there shouldn't be a wall between different parts of the organization when it comes to shipping a specific product. And I think that's really the biggest part of the process that's broken right now.
So, Joe, by the way, you can follow Joe at Joe Stump. And what is the Twitter handle for Sprintly? I'm not sure I'm getting it right.
It's just at Sprintly, S-P-R-I-N-T-L-Y.
Okay, no dot in there. But on the web, it's S-P-R-I-N-T.L-Y is the website.
Yep.
Okay, so basically you're talking about flat organizations. And coming into product management from managing web development. I'm speaking from my direct experience, which early on in a subsidiary of Apple, that was a major frustration that the website involved everyone in the organization. It needed content from everyone in the organization. It needed everybody's touching it and involvement. And organizations are not flat, Joe. I mean, that's what's exciting about, you know, starting a business from the ground up in a startup. You can be flat. You can be sitting in an open environment surrounded by the engineers, the marketers, the managers, and you can talk to everyone. But once organizations reach a certain size, it gets really difficult to have that communication. And I work remotely with a lot of people in small groups. And even with just a couple of us, it's really hard to keep that communication open on a regular basis.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think one of the issues that I see in a lot of our customers' companies is that you have kind of this funnel of communication that happens throughout a company. So if you think of a company kind of as a funnel where, you know, at the very top are the very high touch point areas of the company, so sales, business development, marketing, customer support, and services. Usually those people are using a set of tools, right? So the support people and customer service people are probably using something like Zendesk or User Voice. Salespeople are obviously probably using something like Salesforce or another CRM. Marketing people have tons of analytic tools and things like Cheetah Mail and, you know, their lifecycle emails tools and whatnot. And what I found is that they will triage inbound ideas, right? So like marketing and PR and sales and BD and customer service obviously get a lot of ideas from out there in the world. And then they like kind of triage those, and then those hit another layer of collaboration, which is kind of management, where they decide, okay, this is something that we actually want to build. It's a, you know, it's aligned with vision. It's, you know, it's in, you know, it's towards our goals for the quarter, et cetera. And then they throw it over the wall to yet another kind of collaboration system, which is, you know, usually like something like Sprintly or Jira or Piddle Tracker or whatever. And I think that really the problem kind of as it exists in the communication space today is that people have been targeting collaboration tools at each layer of that filtration kind of funnel system. So, you know, Salesforce and Sales and BD and those types of people have things like Chatter, for instance, right? And then you have the management layer. They're usually collaborating almost exclusively via emails and meetings. Some more sophisticated companies have, you know, obviously collaborative documentation and doc environments and more collaborative kind of things like Yammer and whatnot. And then, you know, there's a whole other collaboration thing that happens with the developers. So everybody's talking and collaborating. They're just not doing it up and down the organization necessarily through their tool set anyway. And I think that's one of the real kind of – that's one of, I think, one of the real opportunities right now in that space.
I so agree. Collaboration. You know, it's really one of the reasons why I started the whole global product management talk, to bring everyone together to discuss these issues. One of the things I find, and we talk about this often, is not only are people using different tools across the organization, but really people have a different orientation and even a different language about how they're responding to those problems. So developers have their own language, and I see often that, you know, there's this great divide between quote-unquote marketers and developers. It's, I would say, a hate-hate relationship. I think the really, from my direct experience, it has to do with just having a different language, different orientation, and a different vision of what needs to happen to guarantee the product success. And they sometimes don't overlap.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. The lack of kind of transparency across the organizations, and really that you know, there is a lot of particularly in the developers, right? Now, I, for everybody listening, I am a developer through and through. You can feel free to look up my code and whatnot. Like, I am one of you until about what I'm about to say, which is that developers, they talk about this in the book Freakonomics, that the notion of an information disparity. Most commonly, like a good example is a car mechanic, right? I'm a pretty smart person, and you you're a pretty smart person, but if the mechanic told us literally your whatchamacallit doohickey is broken on your car and it's going to cost $500 to fix, we're like, I didn't even know my car had a whatchamacallit doohickey. That sounds weird, but okay, whatever. And that's kind of how developers are, right? Like, we know a lot about the system, and you'll see a lot of developers use that to their advantage in these kinds of discussions. So I think that is a big problem for sure. I think that there's also a complete lack of understanding in some defense of the developers. There is a difficult understanding of how difficult it is to do what we do, like, and the cascade effect that some of the changes that are asked for can have on a company or on the code base anyway. So I think those are two problems. And that was one thing actually that I went out of the way at SimpleGeo when we hired our business development guy. We found a candidate that had written banking software in the early 90s, and I was like, this is our guy. Like, at least he knows like how difficult
sure.
it is to do things that are, which should be an easy change, but I do think that verbiage and language disconnect is a big problem. And it's one thing that we focus again on at Sprintly is, I think, a perfect example in prod that every product manager here can probably will empathize with is story points. Story points were a fantastic approach, right? They were basically like, people are really bad at estimating time, so we're going to try and completely abstract the notion of time away from our velocity metrics, right? But the problem is most developers don't understand what a story point is. And when you tell the business development person or the sales or marketing person, like, your thing that you asked for is this many points and it's going to take this long, like, they just completely zone out. They have no idea what you're talking about. So it's certainly, instead we use T-shirt sizes, like small, medium, large XL. Like, everybody knows what an XL means, right? Most of them. Those are definitely big problems.
Super. Hey, I want to just give a shout out to Javi Andres, who's tweeting from Minneapolis, and invite people. You can call in to 323-927-2957. I'm sitting here at Studio 132 with BZ Lewis, our engineer, and he's happy to screen your calls. And by the way, this is our first episode in 2013, and we're constantly iterating, and we'll be moving more into a radio show. So sorry for interrupting your discussion, Joe. But these are you're discussing really key things to what's important and what I see is missing in the cross-functional communication and definitely what blocks the product process. Regarding story points, here again, I think it's a language issue. So it's assuming that everyone is using Agile, understanding Agile, number one. And the other point I wanted to make is when developers start talking about their product, there's no narrative. There's no creating context. They go right into features. They go right into the process. And that's one of the issues that makes it difficult for across the board for other functions to interact with the developers. And really, that's a value add that I see that product managers bring to explaining what is the importance of this product, what is the value, and how all the stakeholders contribute to the product, which I think developers care less about. No offense.
None taken, and I agree with you wholeheartedly. The one thing that I never understood, and this is amazing, right? Like, you'll walk into most companies have some form of a product sync up kind of meeting, right? Where there's usually a director or team lead level kind of meeting happens once a week. Sales, BD, marketing, development, operations, et cetera, all sit around the table and kind of discuss the priorities, right? And the thing I always found amazing about these is they look like UN negotiations. It's like business stakeholders on one side of the table, makers or developers and kind of, DevOps on one side of the table, and then PMs as mediators in the middle. And I always found that really insane as a developer because, I have a business degree. I don't use it a whole lot, but I have one. And so I at least understand, at a very intimate level, like, that sales and BD person over there that you're angry about, you know, that they want this new feature that you disagree with, like, they sign your paycheck effectively. Like, they're the, that's the guy that just signed the, you know, million-dollar deal that's going to pay for the company for the next year and a half. Like, and I think that is a big problem. And one of the probably nicest realizations that I've had is, like, I always felt that way, but as soon as I started really getting into the kind of growth hacking side of things on Sprintly, I was like, holy crap, like, the people on the other side of the table, those sales and marketing and PR people, like, they're hackers too, and I wish that more developers would realize that. Like, the approach that really good kind of sales and marketing and BD people take to, you know, increasing traffic and acquiring customers and how that translates to the bottom line, like, there's a lot of metrics-driven hacking that's happening on that side of the table. It's just not done with code. And I think that, you know, we should give them the same level of respect as you give other hackers.
Thank you. Thank you so much. You know, and this is really what you're addressing, exactly why startup product talks community decided there's a need to have an all-day event to bring everyone together to discuss these issues. So could you define what you mean by growth hacking? There's a blog post at startupproduct.wordpress.com. The first blog post references growth hacking. What's your definition?
My definition is basically an iterative, metrics-driven approach to acquiring and keeping customers. I think one of the things that is often overlooked in growth hacking is the keeping of customers. It's one thing to acquire a customer. You know, you can throw penny, you know, 10-cent clicks at a problem all day long. But another really important side of I think growth hacking is the keeping of customers. And I really think that's the part where product, you know, plays. I mean, you can acquire traffic. I mean, now it's so easy to acquire traffic and customers, as long as you have dollars to throw at it, you can do that. But it's really important that once you do acquire those customers, they stay around and you can monetize them. So my definition of growth hacking is a metrics iterative development or approach to basically acquiring and keeping customers.
Which is really the web delivering the promise of what the beauty of the web is to marketers. From early on, I saw the web as a marketing tool, and it's just taken a long time for it to be being used efficiently and effectively.
Yeah, I think we're really only getting to the point where the whole tool chain is in place. You know, when you look at the sophistication of tools like Kissmetrics and Mixpanel and HubSpot to Optimizely to Crazy Egg to, you know, all of the lifecycle email providers that are out there, you know, to even something as simple as exit surveys and WooFoo and SurveyMonkey and whatnot. Like, I think we have all the tool sets in place right now, and now the people that you're seeing really succeed are the people that are figuring out how to tie all of those together and make them work in unison. I often tell people that your product is a machine and you should think of it that way. And the machine's purpose, no matter what your product is, the machine's purpose is to take $1 in one end and put more than $1 out the other end. And those new tools that we have for the product is really about, if you can get them all working in unison and you can use them to kind of debug how your machine is working. I mean, I finally had this moment as then with Sprintly. I was running the numbers for December, and I had this moment of zen where I was like, holy crap, the machine works. A buck in one end equals more than a dollar out the other end. And then it's just like, once you get to that point, the internet is amazing because it's literally just about putting more people in one end of the machine.
And automating that process.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. We're just now kind of starting to lay the groundwork. And of kind of like this whole end-to-end pipeline. And as a developer, so like I tend to have a more conservative approach to personal data than I think an average marketer would, right? And it's both amazing to the marketer side of my brain and terrifying to the developer side of my brain. Like the level of automation and sophistication of these tools now. Like I can sit and, you know, with tools like Mixpanel and Intercom and things like that, you can literally just be like, well, if this person does this and then doesn't do that within 3 days, I want you to send them this email. And then if you've sent them that email and they still haven't done it 2 days later, I want you to send them this video. And then, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's just, and then things like full contact throw it into a whole completely different realm. Like, it's just, I love it. I'm geeking out on it big time.
Oh, yeah. So, Joe turned me on to Mixpanel over the weekend. Oh, my God. It is, talk about delivering on the promise. It's very, very exciting, the level of information you can get. But it, more than just the information, the feedback that enables you to give the customer what they're looking for, that it's just excellent.
Yeah, the customer intelligent tools that are out there now, you know, are just, if you're only kind of trying to figure out what's wrong with your product with Google Analytics or something like that, you should definitely check out. The ones that I've seen and used and liked are Kissmetrics, Intercom, Mixpanel, and HubSpot.
Excellent. So I can't tweet and talk anymore. I can no longer effectively multitask while I'm speaking. I think I can do it maybe when I'm also not talking. We've been answering a lot of the questions that we had prepared. But here's a big one that not so easy to answer. We're skipping up to Q7 is, how do you determine what are the important KPIs? It's going back to the individual, what I call the individual stakeholders, all the people who are concerned about the product success, they have different metrics. They have different metrics for how their own performance as professionals are being measured, as well as how they're measuring customer engagement and how they're measuring the excellence of the product.
I think that really kind of varies, obviously, from company to company. There is one major KPI everybody should be on board with, which is, of course, revenue. But I think, you know, it really differs. But what I would look for, some advice that I got given to me very early on from somebody that knows a lot more about KPIs than I do, is to track three. To start by tracking three metrics that you believe are good indicators of kind of product health. So some examples of that. If I was doing product development at Digg, I would be wanting to make sure that, you know, the KPIs for Digg would be the number of people digging a story and the retention on that metric, the number of people that are posting new stories and the retention on people coming back and posting another story, and the number of people kind of, you know, commenting on a story. So and then that differs greatly from Sprintly, where Sprintly, the KPIs that I pay attention to that are important to us are number of new items created. So are people creating items and then coming back and creating items? And then also member invites, whether they're inviting people and coming back and inviting people. So I would identify, you know, up to three metrics that you believe are representative of somebody actually using your product, and then those are the ones that you want to continue to kind of push up on retention. I don't actually look that much at just raw numbers. I look a lot more at retention. So are people coming back? Like, really the sign of a successful product is, you know, obviously stickiness. Are people coming back and using it? So it's not very helpful to know that 10,000 people created a new story if only two of them came back. You know, like, that's a much more powerful thing to know than just 10,000 people posted a new story.
You know, just to underline what you're saying, stickiness, that used to be a key term early on in websites. How sticky is it? And now, you know, it doesn't matter how long people are spending on your website. That's just one of the tools on the way to getting them to take action. Really, do we need people to stick on the website? No, we need them to be stuck on the product or using the product.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's, you know, I think, you know, there are a lot of sites that particularly content sites and user-generated content sites that have that problem where it's, you know, stickiness and engagement can be two different things, right? Like time on site is one measurement, but if they're not doing anything other than consuming, that can be difficult, you know, to kind of, it may not be as indicative of product health as how many people are posting, which is a little bit more important on actual engagement.
Sure. And when you're talking about content sites, that's something that I'm seeing content strategists, content marketers, the content is a product. And it may be a separate product from actually what the business, the product, the company is in.
Yeah,
so I'm just suggesting that generating content, marketing content, it requires a similar development process, not on the level of coding, but certainly going back to you referring this content hackers.
Yeah, I think that you're definitely in the same position of where, you know, you're needing to pay attention to the metrics and create features or content, you know, instead of it being a feature, it's a content, right? Like, so I think maybe a good example, that would be my buddy at Ryan Carson at Treehouse. Treehouse is an online education thing where they train you to become a developer, basically. And for him, it may not be that churn is going up because he doesn't have a specific feature. It's probably because he doesn't have specific content. Maybe a new language has become really popular amongst developers or a new framework, and he doesn't have a course for that. So I think a lot of the lessons for, you know, paying attention to your KPIs and driving them forward apply just as equally to people that have content as it does to people that, you know, are more kind of feature-driven tools.
Yes. Yeah. So shout out. Hello, Daniel Seaman and Javi Andres, Lydia Sugarman. Speaking of content, this started as a Twitter chat, and I didn't realize that Twitter chats are products in and of themselves, and there's a whole onboarding process to teach people how to tweet, how to engage in a Twitter chat, and I definitely need to teach people, please tweet the way I would. Take notes. Share what you're thinking in text form.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think the need to teach users is tough because as a UX armchair quarterback of sorts, I really want users to just intuitively know how to use the products. But I think that with any decently sophisticated tool, you're kind of locked into needing to do that.
Right, and as a professional user of products, that is so key. How do you onboard customers to using your product as promised? So we're always promising how this product will, you know, provide value, but getting people to use the product efficiently and effectively is a process. And it's very exciting that speaking, even I started playing with Sprintly. It's a lot of fun how you're onboarding. And then you have built in, I started using the product. It was fun getting through the process. Then I got distracted, and I think I got an email from you, Joe, saying, hey, what happened? Come back. And I was like, are you standing over my shoulder watching how I'm using the product?
Effectively, yes. So we personally use we've used Intercom and we're using Mixpanel as well now for what are called kind of lifecycle emails. And it's this basically what we've done is based on our analytics, our engagement metrics, and some other things that we've identified as being important to customer success. we've created a series of videos and emails that will last throughout your kind of first 30 days, and it's structured kind of like a decision tree. If the user does this but hasn't done this, then I want you to send out this email. So like a good example of that is after 3 days, if you haven't turned on our GitHub integration, we'll send you an email saying, hey, this is how you turn on our GitHub integration, and here's all the cool benefits you get from that. And then if I think after a week, if you haven't used our email integration, you get another email that says, hey, I don't know if you know about our email integration, but it's pretty awesome. You should check it out. One of the things I'm really excited about is tying in all of these tools that do these kind of automated lifecycle emails. They basically will allow you to tag users with custom attributes. And one of the things we started doing here at Sprintly is tagging customers with the campaign ID, the keyword, and then full contact data. So now in my automated lifecycle emails, I know things like how big the company you are that you work for is. I know, you know, what Google campaign you came in on. And if you came in on a campaign, for instance, if you came in on a campaign where I knew that it was mostly people that were coming, you know, that were using one of my competitors' products, I could then send the lifecycle email that says, hey, would you like our help or tutorial on how to import all of your items from that other tool to Sprintly, for instance. Or like, for instance, another thing that we're going to be doing now that we have the person's position, like I'm not going to send a GitHub lifecycle email to somebody that's a salesperson or in marketing. So that's the way we're approaching that stuff.
So that's brilliant. So you're really automating the personalized customer engagement, if you will. And that is so key. For the Startup Product Summit, we have people coming from all different areas because the whole purpose is to bring people who are touching the product at different points together to have this in-depth conversation. And so we started experimenting with different price points for bootstrappers, for CEOs, for product people. But it's very difficult to track where are they coming from and what should we be sending them appropriate to engaging them in the conversation even prior to the start of the summit.
Yeah.
So.
Wait, what?
I was just taking your point of how you're onboarding customers and engaging customers in Sprintly and how you're managing them by assigning a campaign ID and following them, identifying where they came from so they get customized messaging from you. I was just relating the pain of how to do that with every product and with every to the point of people coming to a live event. I think it's a pain point for any type of product and necessary. And people are now expecting it. They're expecting to get information relevant to their moment in time, to what their experience is at this moment. The information has to be relevant or we've lost them.
Yep. Yeah, I totally agree. I think and I think that's why, you know, it's so amazing that we're starting to have these really sophisticated tools, because a salesperson or a marketer can look like, you know, they know over time what certain demographics like about the product, what they don't like about the product, what's important to successful customers and things like that. And whereas, you know, before we would have, effectively like an account executive, right? The sales guy closes the deal and or the account exec sets them up with the tool and, you know, gets them all dialed in and everything. And I think now with, you know, as we're starting to come out with, there's been a move across business to move to more lighter kind of SaaS-based tools. Now that we're kind of moving into that realm, there's a real opportunity along with the new tool set to just completely automate what an account exec used to effectively do.
Yeah, so really we're automating the entire sales process,
Yeah, more and more.
Which, again, works easily and obviously for web-based products, maybe a longer time for a longer sales process, an enterprise product, and a bigger ticket item?
Yeah, so I think that as far as those follow-up lifecycle emails go, they apply to, it doesn't really matter, like, you know, a couple years ago I bought like a really nice car, and I had to like email the guy that I bought it from because I hadn't owned a car for like 3 years, and before that I hadn't owned any car that was sophisticated as this. And it would have been a lot nicer if like BMW just sent me an email like, hey, this is, you know, we know that 90% of our customers don't understand how the courtesy key works. So here's a little video on how that works, right? I actually had to email the dealership like 3 separate occasions because I was like, the car is doing something and I don't understand how it's doing it or why it's doing it. And like, so I think that, you know, that kind of automated, targeted follow-up process could work just as well for big ticket items, because it happens after, generally speaking, it happens after the transaction has happened.
Yes. So I wanted to shout out to some of the great tweets happening. Javi Andres had said, automating engagement and following up with customers is just good business, especially if the business model requires repeat purchases. Of course, that is the goal. That is the ideal, to automatically engage with every customer personally, according to what their needs are. And
people love the fact that, you know, that email that gets automatically sent out saying, hey, I saw that you've, you know, been hanging out on Sprintly. Would you like a live demo? Is there anything we can do to help? That comes directly from my personal email address. So you hit reply on that, and it goes directly back to us. And all of our lifecycle emails, the reply to is our support channel. And there's one thing that, you know, I think that has not disappeared as we moved on to, you know, this kind of digital product, you know, phase of whatever, of business, is that people like a personal kind of touch. And if you can provide that in a way that is remotely scalable, you know, I don't get a ton of replies. We get hundreds of people signing up every month on Sprintly. I don't get like a ridiculous amount of people replying back to me. But I do know that out of the people that reply to me, they're like, I think it's amazing that the CEO emailed me a couple hours after I signed up and that I was able to reply directly back to his inbox. And, you know, I don't think that I know the owner and, you know, he helps me out once in a while. That feeling has not disappeared now that we've got, you know, products that are intangible to us.
So talking about this personalization of getting an email from the CEO, I see this as a real deconstruction of business as usual. That we're talking about having a personal interaction with every user of our product, which is totally flies in the face of what multinational businesses have previously done, or let me say the corporate feel was all about you're interacting with a corporate brand and we are not individual people here. And so I see this as a positive approach. Look, every person that's using your product is an individual person. Even if they're business professionals, they're still doing their own email. They're still doing their own purchases. They're still individual people. And look, if you can make your business product or the interaction or every touch point generate value in that experience, so it's fun to use a product or it's fun to have this interaction, then people are going to engage more. It doesn't matter how serious the product is. We're all human beings using the product, reading the messaging. We need to be talking to human beings more. So just the fact that this is something that I see as a changing of the guard, a real, you know, I don't know, if 40 is a cutoff point, people under 40 get this, and just with all the interactions that they do, and there's no distinction between business, non-business, or between office hours and non-office hours.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things playing into this. First of all, I completely agree with you. I think there's definitely a trend towards, you know, what I would almost refer to, particularly I live in Portland, and a lot of people ask me, like, what's different about Portland? And Portland is a city that's filled with craftsmen. Like, you come here and there's urban farmers, and that feeds into the brewers and the coffee places and the restaurants here, and there's a really good kind of, you know, self-feeding ecosystem that's highly distributed, peer-to-peer and small. And it's almost like this notion of kind of a small batch society where everything is made in small batches by kind of, you know, individual craftsmen, which wasn't a viable thing to do before the internet. There was no Etsy. There was no, like, Amplify for selling T-shirts and things like that, you know. And I think that's been largely driven by the millennials. I read a report that was done actually by our fraternity a decade ago, which is a little random, about millennials. And they are a dramatically different generation than both baby boomers and Gen Xers in that they're very focused on basically, they're also called the Y generation, as in they want to know why, and they want to have basically a personal kind of approach and touch to everything. Like, that's really important to them, that they know that, you know, that the coffee that they drink is coming from a sustainable local business that is, you know, going back to a sustainable kind of, you know, co-op in South America or whatever. So I think that's driving a lot of it. And then I think the other part is it's just the internet makes it possible. You know, these connected systems that we have in place that are working in unison to kind of keep us engaged with our customers, like, they, you know, they didn't exist 5 years ago. And they certainly don't exist to the level of sophistication that we have online in the brick and mortar world. To your one specific point about, you know, being able to know, like, the face behind the company, there's a book out there that I consider kind of my Bible. It's called The Luxury Strategy. It was written by former CEO of Louis Vuitton. And one of the things that he points out as being a major difference of luxury products is that people are actually okay with the idiosyncrasies of luxury products. For instance, a Rolex is a $30,000 watch that you have to wind, right? And they put up with that because they know that there is a true craftsman behind that watch. There was a person that made that and poured kind of like time and knowledge and sweat and tears into that product. And they consider that like a key harbinger of a luxury product. And that's something that we've definitely tried to emulate at Sprintly. We put ourselves out there, and it's like, look, it's just four dudes in Portland. We are working our butts off to deliver you a fantastic product. And we pour and sweat over every single detail, and we hope that you love it as much as we do, right? And I think that message has a much bigger impact on the customer than, you know, we are this large faceless organization. You call this 1-800 number if you have a problem. Everybody is on message, if that makes sense.
Yeah. The personalization of product, definitely you touched upon, you know, the craft behind the product and the whole orientation of being a craftsman and taking pride in that product and having a direct relationship to the users of the product. It's almost taking the indie world into mass automation of web products, the DIY.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing this with Kickstarter, we're seeing this, you know, with Etsy. I think a couple of people have started calling it like the peer-to-peer economy. And, you know, you have things like, well, even locally here, I've been doing a very rudimentary financial model around buying a used car, a 4x4, and renting it on get around or relay rides. So there's like this whole notion that basically like, that we're shifting, that there's this economy of sharing and peer-to-peerness that's happening, that I don't think that there wouldn't have been the economies of scale available prior to the internet. And I think that's why that luxury book is – the luxury strategy is so interesting to me, because those guys basically are describing how to build and maintain a niche product and a niche brand. And you know, before that, if you think of like old school niche products and niche brands, I think two are good examples are like custom bike frames and comic book stores, right? Comic book store before the internet, you really had to be in a big city in order to extract a large enough niche audience to make that a profitable business. But now with the internet, there's 2 billion people that are all connected to the same marketplace. And there are plenty of people with plenty of niche interests on the internet, and they're all congregating and they're all collaborating with each other. So I think that's really what makes, you know, what we're doing on the internet so powerful and engaging is that we've got 2 billion people now, there's 6.6 billion mobile subscribers, they're all going to be coming online in short order. So pretty soon you're going to be able to have a product with sophisticated tools that cost you, you know, I don't know, $100 a month kind of thing, to sell to and extract a niche audience from 6 billion people worldwide. And then, of course, you don't have to worry about shipping. Half the time you don't have to worry about fulfillment. Like, it's getting to the point where a one-man show is total. It can be a very, very sophisticated, high-end, you know, well-oiled one-man show machine.
For sure. Gosh, and we're at the end of the hour, Joe, and we're just now getting into the stuff that I really love talking about. And
oh, no.
But it's all of the above. All of the above. But and this is really the driving force behind, again, why we're doing the first Startup Product Summit on February 7th in San Francisco. Joe is a featured speaker. We expect the audience to be engaged with the conversation in person. We hope to have tweeting. We're working on live streaming, but it's really a grassroots community that's bringing this summit about. So please check it out at startupproduct.com. Join us. I promised to give away everyone who is interested in attending. You can get $50 off by registering at startupproduct.ticketbud.com/summit. Use the special code SFProductTalks. And definitely join us if you're in the Bay Area at sfproducttalks.com. This week, our co-host, Nick Muldoon, formerly of Atlassian, is moving on to Twitter, and he is talking about his experience of going from product management to product marketing and back again. So join the community in person at Atlassian this week. Go to sfproducttalks.com to join, and don't tell Nick, but we're going to have a cake to celebrate his going on to Twitter, but we will continue to meet at Atlassian on a regular basis, hopefully. And Joe, you also promised a unlimited free trial of Sprintly. How do people get that?
So do we pick a winner, or how do we work that?
Person gets that. Okay, so all you people who have been tweeting, when we go offline, I will get the stats on the Twitter engagement, and we will reward one winner. Oh, shucks, I wanted that, Joe, of 6 months of free trial of Sprintly. That's sprint.ly. Join me. I moderate the AIPMM webinar series this Friday. We are talking about product managers in the SaaS, the software as a service product management with Tom Evans. So go to AIPMM.com and register for the upcoming webinar. Join us next week here on Global Product Management Talk, where we're talking with Chad McAllister on product innovation and innovation processes. There's a 3-day package available through the AIPMM. If you want to come to San Francisco, there's a 2-day intensive to become a product innovation leader and achieve the Certified Innovation Leader credential through the AIPMM and join the Startup Product Summit. You can email me directly, Cindy at PRODMGMTTALK.com for more information about getting that $16.97 discount price for the 3 days of the Product Innovation Leadership Training and the Startup Product Summit. Thank you again to our sponsors. We have lots of great plans for the Global Product Management Talk this year, including more Google Hangouts and more digital events besides this podcast. Thank you to our engineer here across the window, BZ Lewis of Studio132.com. Any last minute and quick comments, Joe?
Just my favorite quote regarding product management and process is you can't ship process.
You cannot ship process.
Yes. So many people focus so much on process, thinking that's going to make their product ship faster when they should actually be focusing on shipping their product faster.
It's about the product, and it's about the product team and team collaboration. So thank you again, Joe. Look forward to continued conversation with you and meeting you in person at Startup Product Summit. This is Cindy F. Solomon. Thanks for joining us in 2013. Follow us on blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMTTALK and shoot me an email if you'd like to sponsor and reach our growing audience of over 20,000 listeners. It's so exciting. So thanks again. And have a great week.
Thanks, you too.
Discover how to work together to develop amazing products. Startup Product Summit, February 7th, 2013. Startupproduct.com. Join us in person for lively discussions and great networking with product professionals at Startup Product Talk San Francisco Monthly. Go to sfproducttalks.com to find out more. Our intro theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com and the great Mark Blasco. We are broadcasting live from Studio132.com. As a top 10 business podcast on the Blog Talk Radio Network, we receive 10,000 listens per week. Imagine your brand engaged with our audience for over 50 minutes on their personal devices. Sponsor us. Email sponsor@PRODMGMTTALK.com for more information.